7. Fuck it, stupid show. I get the news over the phone from Laura Folger. I have not been chosen. She tells me how close I was, how much they liked me, how sad my story was, and it was. But that mine was one of hundreds, that I was only one of so many, most of them younger than me, carrying around this sort of cross and that kind of baggage, people with the sorriest backgrounds, but that, in the end, they couldn't use more than one suburban white male, that they had to settle on one, and he was not to be me. My spot, my catapult, had been taken by someone named Judd. Judd? I say. Yes, she says. Judd? Yeah, he's a cartoonist. Fuck it. It's just as well. It's a relief. It would have been wrong. It would have been wrong, right? It would have been wrong. It's a stupid show, a show that's almost unbearable to watch. Everyone on it made hideous, silly and simple, two-dimensional. Fuck it. Let the cartoonist be made into a cartoon. I don't need it. We don't need it. We don't need the real world. We don't need any crutches. We don't need an ongoing role on a television show with a massive worldwide audience and an unquantifiable kind of influence over the hearts and minds of the young and impressionable. No, we will continue against the odds with only these simple tools, these small hands. We'll make this thing run on nothing, on fumes if need be, on our own fumes, whatever. In a few weeks, we get a thick envelope in the mail from this Judd Winnick. His stationery has drawings on it, dozens of little characters with funny expressions in various funny poses. He is, for some reason, looking for work from us, and so has sent easily 500 comic strips, what seems to be each and every installment from a daily strip he did throughout college. The cartoons, about a bunch of young people, the protagonist is a lesbian, a fact of life in the 90s, see, living in a brownstone somewhere, are decent, very traditional, crafted well. But not for us. In the month or so since that first issue, Might has become something different. We are much less inspired than we were then, and going through with another one seems, on a certain level, more dutiful than impassioned. After all, the last thing we want from this, or at least the last thing I want from this, is some kind of job. We have to avoid that kind of cruelly ironic fate, that we, the loudmouths who so cloyingly espouse the unshackling of one's ideas about work and life, themselves become slaves to something, to a schedule, obligated to advertisers, investors, keeping regular hours. Yes, we still care about changing the lives of our peers and, of course, the world, and still expect at some point to be sent into space, but, on the other hand, we have narrowed our scope and sharpened our knives. We have targets now. We have decided upon good guys and bad guys, friends, enemies, obstacles. We begin a pattern of almost immediate opinion reversal and self-devouring. Whatever the prevailing thinking, especially our own, we contradict it, reflexively, and mock ourselves. We change our minds about Wendy Kopp, the young go-getter we heralded in the first issue, and her much-celebrated Teach for America. We are absolute bastards. Where we originally praised her gumption and her organization's goals to bring young, enthusiastic, well-educated teachers into underprivileged schools for 2 years, now, in a 6,000-word piece that dominates the second issue, we fault the nonprofit for attempting to solve inner-city problems, largely black problems, with white, upper-middle-class, college-educated solutions. Paternalistic condescension, we say. Enlightened self-interest, we sigh. Noblesse oblige, we sneer. We quote a professor, summing up, a study of Teach for America tells us more about the ideological, even psychological needs of today's middle-class white and minority youth than it does about the underclass to whom the project is targeted. Kaboom! And because the general public will not believe that we have been chosen to articulate the hopes and fears of a people, to speak for them and everyone and make history, we set out to see what they will believe. The cover of the second issue celebrates the magazine's first 50 years, with a grid of 20 or so past covers. October 1964, The Beatles Are Reds. November 1948, Death, The Hidden Killer. To prove it. The opening essay, written a month or so after Kurt Cobain's death, touches on a death that touched us all. It's so hard to believe you're gone. Even now, I wake with a sense of disbelief. You're gone. Each morning I rise reluctantly, wondering whether to live the day or just let it wash over me. I walk numbly, listlessly, drifting like a phantom. I feel apart from my body. I am half a person. You're gone. From the start, everyone knew you were different. There was something more there, A mysterious glow, a strange, unfamiliar beauty. But somehow, I felt like I'd known you all my life. Maybe I did. Could it be? I always believed in you, and I believe you always believed in me. You spoke to me, about me, for me. During some of my most trying times, you shone like a beacon of guidance and strength, a rock, someone real. I idolized you. I wanted to be you. Some said you were messed up, disturbed, a bad role model. Some said power changed you, that you couldn't handle it. They said your style was scandalous, your conduct immoral, and that's true. You were abrasive, gritty, and tough. You were reckless, a loner. And sometimes you just made me mad. But that's because I loved you, and because, despite everything, I always trusted you. And then it happened. But it wasn't your fault. It was our fault. My fault. For everything we put you through, that life put you through, that you put yourself through, I'm sorry. Your struggles with fame, with success, with the press, I know you really never meant to hurt anyone. How can a butterfly cause harm? It is with high hopes and a full heart that I say, Richard Milhouse Nixon, beautiful butterfly, fly free, fly strong, live forever. I love you. We seek out those who, like us, had ideas but have run aground. We publish an interview with Philip Paley, a former child actor who played Chaka the Bakuni on Land of the Lost, in which he excoriates his parents, blaming their divorce for his semi-indigent state, living in a humble apartment in Hollywood. Trouble in Paradise? Yeah. My parents divorced when I was 16, and subsequently all my money got tied up in that divorce. I lost it all. To this day, I'm still fucking pissed off about it. Put that in your magazine. My father is a Beverly Hills surgeon with money, and my mother got a really large divorce settlement. I don't talk to them. And what are you doing now? I have done every fucking job you can imagine. My first job was at Swenson, scooping ice cream. I was a baker, a gas station attendant, a pastry chef. I worked at E.F. Hutton as an assistant broker. I worked at a stationery store. I was a painter. I tore down buildings with my bare hands. A lot of unemployment time.
So there goes the myth that child stars are set for life.
Yeah, it broke the myth for me.
The last page of the issue is a fake ad featuring five of our friends for something called Street Harmony Jeans. The five friends as models are posed in a corner of South Park, one sitting on a dumpster, two others draped against warehouse walls, and, at the center, is Meredith pouting at the camera while dropping a quarter into a cup held by a hairy panhandler. The homeless man, played by our motorcycle repairman friend Jamie, is grinning, giving a thumbs up, and holding a cardboard sign that says,
"Will work for fashion."
And somehow we think this sort of thing will endear us to advertisers. Not that we need clothing ads or tobacco ads or ads from big companies or anyone, forget it. But as short-sighted and pessimistic as we've become, we still cling to the idea that the right moves might quickly reverse our fortunes. Thus, Moody and I sit around, looking at Judd's cartoons, wondering if we should have him come on down, show us more work, talk about contributing. We agree that he is not at all a good fit for Might, thematically or aesthetically. He has nothing at all to do with what we're about, really, except that he... We clamber for the phone. I make the call.
Yeah, why don't you come down and bring the cameras, or your portfolio?
2 days later, he does come by. He walks in, a regular-looking person with thick black hair, and we get up to greet him and are then confronted, close at his heels, by a scampering eight-legged insect of black video equipment, lights, microphones, clipboards. Shalini, an MTV devotee, at her Mac across the room, is awestruck. We had forgotten to tell her they were coming. It's chaos. People walking by on the sidewalk outside stop and press their faces against the window. We bring Judd to our conference table, under the punching bag, and begin the show. Judd, with his portfolio, pretends that he really cares about having his work published in our tiny magazine, with its 10,000 readers, even though in 2 months millions will be watching his every quiver. Moody and I sit with him, pretending that we are editors of a real magazine, one where people sit down to talk about things like this, and that we care about his work and believe that it belongs in our real magazine. We are wearing what we always wear, shorts and t-shirts, having decided, after thinking about what to wear and then remembering not to think about what to wear what we would have worn had we not been thinking about what to wear. We are happy with our shorts and t-shirts, one side tucked in, just an inch of it on the right side, showing some belt, the rest hanging out. This is our look. It having been arrived at in high school through careful consideration, through the eschewing of so many possible mistakes. We wear no tattoos because we feel tattoos indicate too much attention paid to one's look, and anyway, though the trend is still in the upswing in 1994, we are sure that inside a year, maybe just only a few months, that whole boom will go bust. How long, after all, could something like that last? Same with dyed hair, piercings, brandings, creative headwear, neckwear, t-shirt wear, all other indications and accoutrements. We have opted out, taken the ultimate apathetic approach to looks and attire, have moved past the check-me-out look, past the look of rejecting the check-me-out look in favor of darkly rebellious look, have rejected both and have chosen a kind of elegance through refusal, the check-me-out-if-you-must look, but you'll get no encouragement from me look, the look of absolutely no look at all. Which is not to say we wouldn't mind looking good, Moody and I, because it would be nice, since we're bothering to slum on MTV and all, to at least be looking appealing, thus increasing our chances of sleeping with Charles Bronson's daughter, or at least the girl from Cafe Centro, the one with the hair down to here, the legs up to there. We talked to Judd, with both grave seriousness and measured nonchalance, about how and how often we will be working together, all the while choosing our words carefully, needing to sound both articulate and casual, of our demographic, loose but smart, energetic but not eager, because, of course, we are also young people pretending to be young people, putting across an image of ourselves as representatives, for now and posterity, of how youth were at this juncture, how we acted, and in particular, how we acted when we were pretending not to act while pretending to be ourselves. At the same time, it would also be nice to make clear the mistake Laura in casting has made, to have our cameo make clear who the real stars are, stars who far outshine this dowdy Judd person. We, the brilliant ringed planets, he just a tiny cold moon. And while we must relate to Judd mano a mano, Judd being on first impression and thereafter a very, very nice person, Moody and I must also try to act cooler than Judd because we have to make clear that we are not the sorts of people who would be on the real world, or even try out for it, in the first place. We need to make clear to a casual viewer that while we are willing to let ourselves be thrust into rec rooms and basements around the world, gazed at by surely adoring teenage girls and their less believing older brothers, by college students eating falafel between classes on couches that came with their apartment, we must make clear to these people that we are on this show only for the purposes of our own perverse amusement, that if you look closely, we are winking, smirking ever so slightly, that all this, our meeting with him, the cameras and everything, will probably be used in might as fodder for some kind of wry and trenchant article or ha-ha chart soon enough. We can play it both ways, always. We can look into the eyes of this Judd person whose eyes look like ours, and we can pour forth to him kindness and understanding, and crack jokes with him and make plans with him, all the while calculating what we might be able to get out of this association, how much of his sort of access we can get without having to too seriously compromise the purity of our own endeavor by fouling it with his presence. He who, for his part, is probably only talking to us because casting Laura felt bad about cutting me from the team, and so sent him our way as consolation. And even while we think we're pulling it off, that we are acting nonchalantly like ourselves, are looking good, are discussing matters vital to Judd's career, the importance of these cartoons to us and him, something weird is happening. The camera guy and the sound guy, slightly older, backward hat wearers, are clearly unimpressed, are almost rolling their eyes at us because they clearly see through the whole thing, that we are using this to get exposure, to prove to all and ourselves that we are real, that we, like everyone else, simply want our lives on tape, proven, feel that what we are doing only becomes real once it has been entered into the record. After the first visit, Judd comes by 3 or 4 more times. And a few months later, when the San Francisco Real Worlds burst onto the air, Moody and I are there in episode 2. For about 8 seconds, of course, but with that 8 seconds, we expect to raise the eyebrows of thick-skulled and star-struck advertising-buying proles, not to mention impress people from college and high school. We get one wish, but not the other. The appearance does next to nothing in terms of solving our financial woes, but on the other hand, everyone we know and have ever known calls or writes to say they saw it. How they're able in the blink that constitutes our appearance to make out who we are is beyond comprehension. We hear from grade school friends we haven't heard from in 8 years. We hear from old teachers, all no doubt because the words spoken to Judd, by me in an appealing sort of drone, were emblematic, unforgettable. Those words? If you, you know, don't draw the way you want to draw, it's going to suck. The appearance makes us mini-celebrities in the neighborhood, particularly in the eyes of Shalini, who's busy with the new voice of the progressive South Asian-American 20-something community. In it are articles about the persistence of arranged marriages, gang activity in the South Asian-American community, and a health advice column written by her father, a doctor. Moody and I design it in exchange for use of her laser printer and for her thrillingly frequent, unbelievable, semi-erotic during work back rubs. Friends, people from upstairs, begin to avoid our office because each time they step in, Shalini is kneading our shoulders as we moan, grunt, pant, often while being entertained by her brutal imitation of Indians she calls FOBs, fresh off the boat.
Oh, I think that you are too dense. Feel the tension in your shoulders. You need to go out, relax more, go do the dancing, do partying with the other youngsters.
She is constantly bothering us about the hours we keep, also about our need to work out more.
You would look much better if you worked out some.
We offer to fulfill her obvious wish to see us naked by inviting her to our next photo shoot.
I don't have to be nude, do I?
Actually, yes.
No.
No, you won't do it, or no, you don't believe us?
Both. No.
But Judd says yes. It's our second big nude shoot. This time we are setting out to demonstrate what people's bodies actually look like, the exercise being a response to a familiar complaint, of course. The media's and advertising's distortion of our perceptions of our own bodies, how the average person does not and cannot meet the unattainable expectations rammed down our blah, blah, blah. What we want to do, just to see if it'll work, as much as anything, is to assemble 30 or 40 friends and acquaintances, ideally being of 30 or 40 different sizes and shapes, and have them pose naked. We will then display the pictures on the page, unadorned, in a simple grid, one God-given body after another, making clear how seldom actual people look like the people seen on TV, how all bodies, while not necessarily all beautiful, or at the very least valid, are real and... Okay, so... We hire a photographer, a sober, soft-spoken Dutch fellow named Ron Van Dongen, who will do the shoot, this groundbreaking shoot, almost for free. He asks only for the cost of film and a chance to keep the negatives. Yes. So, in the interest of demonstrating inclusiveness and diversity, in the interest of making clear that differentiating between this one and that one, discriminating on the basis of size or shape or color, these superficial distinctions is obscene, barbaric, in the interest of setting all this straight, we make calls looking for volunteers. Do you have any black friends?
Oh, yeah? How light?
Really? I thought he was Indian.
How about large friends?
No, we need guys. We already have enough women.
How big is he?
You think he'd do it?
Also, do you know anyone flat-chested?
Like flat-flat. Bony.
Where is the scar?
Is it noticeable?
She has hair where?
In contrast to the first naked photo shoot, this time it's infinitely easier to find people because at this point we have an actual magazine to show people, and because this time there will be no running with penis flapping, and early on we make two compromises. A, we promise to grant anonymity by cropping the pictures at the neck, and B, we let everyone wear underwear, if not on top, at least on the bottom. We do this for them as much as for practical reasons, realizing with a deep, regret-filled sigh that filling our pages with stark naked people, particularly those whose bodies are clearly imperfect, will not help the magazine's struggling newsstand distribution. Yes, it's another heartbreaking compromise, and do know that each one is a five-lane highway through our souls.
But this point must reach America, however tattered it is once it arrives.
Judd says he'll be bringing a friend, another member of the cast.
We are thrilled. With two cast members present, this will definitely get on the air. This will be the thing that pushes us over the edge. And when we see the car coming down the alleyway, an old periwinkle blue Dodge or something, a prototypically San Francisco car, a boxy, sun-washed old thing, we can feel the pieces coming together, our doing something sociologically huge with appropriately sized media coverage, a loud point being properly amplified, disseminated to millions...
There are no cameras.
They drive up and there is no van following them. I meet them at the car as they park in the alley behind the studio, and as casually as I can, I look up and down the alley for the van. But there is no van. There are no cameras. We have expected cameras.
Hey,
I say.
Hey,
Judd says.
So, no camera crew, huh?
Nah, they're with Rachel today.
Oh.
Well, good. We sure didn't want those cameras getting in our way today, messing everything up.
Right.
Cameras can be so distracting.
Yeah.
In your face, recording everything, all the things you say and do.
Right.
Oh, this is Puck.
Hey.
Hey!
I shake hands with Puck. He is wearing long shorts and a white tank top. He is rangy, pale, his eyes alert in a jarring sort of way. As I have his hand, he starts talking, quickly, without taking breaths, without blinking. When I hear Puck talk, I immediately wonder if Puck is on some kind of speed-oriented drug, some kind of hallucinogen. I have seen TV movies about people on such drugs. There was one with Doug McKeon and Helen Hunt, where she takes PCP and jumps out the school window, falls two stories, gets up, runs around, dies. Maybe Puck is on speed. Is this what speed is like? He will not stop talking. He is talking about the real world and how he's going to ride it all the way to the top, that there's no stopping him, that he's also a bike messenger, you know, that car, road cuts, racing, motocross, fuck yeah, shit cool, all the way to the top. He is easily the most unsettling person I have ever met. He has scratches all over his body, including his face. Maybe his cats? It's hard to tell. He will not stop talking. Used to ride motocross, and there's some fine women in the cast, but they seem frigid, and yeah, got an agent, and party cool shit, yeah, dude, all right, got a split soon, all right, dude. He is fantastic and horrible. He is magnetic and repulsive. His eyes are hungry. Fucking yeah, should have seen it, dumb shits, mama's bruise, Ollie, rad bitchin'. He pulls up his shirt to show us his tats. We all mill in the alley, waiting for our turn with Van Dongen. Kirsten, always the good sport, arrives, and Carla, a smattering of interns and friends, their friends. We have called everyone we know. One by one, we walk in, close the door behind us, and are alone with Van Dongen in the studio. He motions us to step into a U of white screens and gestures for us to take off our clothes, whatever it is we're planning to take off. We do. And when we do, fumbling with exactly what to do with our arms, our hands, we wonder what he thinks of our bodies. We do not know what to do with our hands. We have them at our sides, then in front of our privates, then behind our backs. What can one do with one's hands when the camera is interested in other things? When he shoots, the flashes in front of us and behind us are all whoosh at once, and we are frozen in the white. Then it is dark again. He takes about 5 pictures of each person, a few of the front, a few of the back. We can't afford the film to do more. And then we are done, opening the studio's heavy door to the overwhelming light, 100 times that of the flashes. San Francisco at midday. But we approve of these people, those who agree to be naked. We think less of those who refuse to do this, our many friends who said no. We deem them not only overly chaste, but stingy, small, lacking in heart, a basic sort of courage. We favor those who pose, favor further those who, like Moody, Marnie, and me, and Puck, offer to pose nude, even though the shots are unlikely to be used. Naked! Naked means something, we decide. Those who pose are our people, people who are living the sorts of grabbing lives we favor, people who cannot say no. With all this, how could anyone possibly say no? In the alley, Puck becomes impatient. Party shit, move chicks, fuck yeah, motocross, X9, 45, GV, boozing, gotta split. As we are talking, or he is talking, a small dog comes to us, literally sniffing around. We play with the dog and soon discover that the dog, though looking well cared for, has no tags. Shortly after meeting the dog, Puck decides that he will be keeping the dog. When he is done with his shoot, Puck and Judd leave, and over our protests and Judd's, Puck grabs the dog, who no doubt belongs to a nearby resident, and brings him to the real-world compound, where he will join the cast. Shortly thereafter, when I'm at the house, the one time I visit, playing pool with Judd, I see the dog and see the other cast members lolling about with seemingly nothing at all to do.
the show having cornered them into a weird problem because they're discouraged from working, boring, or traveling,
unfeasible.
They cannot produce and cannot move, are left to wander from couch to kitchen to bed, talking and waiting to offend or be offended. When we get the pictures back, Moody and I pore over them for hours on end. We study them, try to identify who is who, but because the subjects' heads are cut off, we cannot immediately discern identities, even our own. We cannot tell the difference between one of our interns and a large furry man who showed up unannounced. We cannot, much to my embarrassment, tell the difference between Kirsten and Carla, who are both thin and unblemished. Most unsettlingly, it takes a second to tell me from Puck. We have the same shorts, the same build, the same stance. The only difference lies in the tattoos. I have none, while he is a bunny, a bumblebee, a bird. Otherwise, we are shocked by the variance of people, the oddness of our peers, how high that large-breasted woman wears her bra, how furry that guy's back is, how unusually shaped that one's shoulders, how flat this one's butt. It's all so much weirder than we imagined. The variety of malformities, the unexpected flaws, the premature sagging, all the tattoos, flowers and snakes, how hairy all the crotches are, bursting from panties and briefs. That one woman who, even with her breasts obvious, convincing, somehow seems too like a man. These people are freaks. Worse, Toph thinks he is one of us. Though he had always spent time with my friends, since he was tiny he had known Flag, Moody, Marnie, et al., had considered them his own friends. Lately, the confusion had reached a new, distressing level. Though he was doing fine socially, at school, he had been lethargic about pursuing friendships with kids his own age. He couldn't believe the stupid things they said. The girls were hopeless, the boys just a little better. And so he was never hesitant to attend any social gathering of my own demographic, shied away from no one, especially if the attendees, mostly strangers, were up for a rousing sort of parlor game. It was not uncommon to find Toph at one of Marnie's barbecues in the middle of 15-20 people sitting on two couches arranged in a V, briefing the assembled on the rules and subtleties of charades, a game I did not teach him but which he knew very well and could readily organize. His presence was so expected socially and at the office. Paul.
Hey, Toph.
Moody.
Hey, little man.
That when someone noticed him for being him, we would all have to stand back a second and see him for what he actually was, at least superficially. A seventh-grade boy. Of course, he had a difficult time discerning himself. He had recently made this clear when he and Marnie and I were driving back from the beach. She and I were talking about one of the new interns who, at 22, was much younger than we had assumed.
Really? Said Toph. I thought he was our age.
He was in the back seat, leaning forward, head peeking between us.
Oh, my God,
said Marnie, and burst out cackling. It took Toph another few beats to realize what he had said. I turned to him. You're 11, Toph. He blushed and sat back down. Marnie kept roaring. But as much as I want to encourage his mingling with his own age group, I fear that if he becomes too involved elsewhere, he won't be ever available for my own needs. What would one do if one did not have a Toph, sitting in his room, ready at a moment's notice, always willing to run one's errands, to be pushed against a wall and have his kidney punched, to be brought, as he is at the moment, to the Berkeley Marina for the throwing back and forth of things? To not have Toph would be to not have a life. We go to the marina when we want to throw by the water and can't make the long drive to the ocean. The marina is some kind of landfill jutting, finger-like, straight into the bay from University Avenue. Past the docked boats and the restaurant and club, there is a park running parallel, a huge rolling park, mostly treeless and green. It's a kite flyer's haven, especially at its farthermost point, the point farthest into the bay. It's always crowded with people flying kites, a few kids, their parents, but the kite flyers are primarily the semi-professional sort, with their box kites and dual-handled remote-controlled F-16 Tomcat kites, kites with the detailing and windows and cockpits, trick kites with elaborate cantilevers and 30-foot tails, swooping up and back, quick diagonals down to touch the grass, then shooting back up again, their masters looking stern, purposeful, captains at the helm. They park their campers and vans right there, on the cul-de-sac that almost meets the bay, and sit, on folding chairs, chatting about better brands of string, or conventions for all the kite people, or how they can better get in our way,
completely get in our way, driving us fucking crazy, while we're trying to throw.
When we go to the marina, we pray that they will not be there, but this time, like most times, they are there.
We park and leave our shoes in the car, get the stuff out. Toph with his, "Hey, you can't wear that hat."
"What do you mean?"
he says.
"We're wearing the same hat.
You have to take yours off."
"No, you.
No, you. My hair'll look weirder."
"No, it won't."
"Yes, it will. Your hair's still straight. You know what I look like with hat head."
"Too bad."
"What?
No."
"Come on, please."
"No."
"Toph!"
"Fine."
"Thanks."
"Freak."
We come prepared, with a variety of things we can throw back and forth. First the football, the enjoyment of which never lasts long because Toph's hand is still too small to get around it. Then baseball, which we really need to practice because the team he's on now is better than the last one. He's with older kids, tall and strong, and he's starting to get spanked, abused, suddenly left behind. Stuck in the outfield, sometimes in right field. A humiliation for both of us after all these years of work. So we do fly balls, trying hard, but not too hard, to avoid hitting the kites, knocking them out of the sky as they bob and weave above us, their strings slashing between us.
"He is missing the ball."
"He is missing the ball because he is experimenting, doing tricks." "Hey, skip the basket catches, fancy man."
"Skip the basket catches, fancy man."
"Bite me."
"Bite me."
"Today we are imitating me." We drop the mitts and play frisbee, and wait for the awed crowds to form. There is not quite the room here that there is on the beach or at the park in the hills, and the shorter playing field necessitates a certain delicacy, obviates the need for the brutal force we usually put into the throwing, makes impossible the long, high, epic sorts of throws for which we are known and acclaimed. But we make do, slicing the frisbee through the diagonal kite strings, curving it around passers-by, catching it, of course, in any number of wildly impressive ways, through our legs, but not like some frisbee weenie, behind the back, while jumping, half-twisting, left to right, and after tipping it 2, 3, 4 times, taming it, slowing it to a weak spin, retiring it for the one-fingered catch. We are so good. Everyone thinks so. In front of us, a couple, the man black and the woman white, are walking with their girl, about 4, whose skin is the color of a walnut. The girl's skin is a hue much more beautiful than either of her parents, and remarkable in how rudimentarily she is the product of her parents' mixed pigments. Brown and white make light brown, the color of skin mixing like paint.
"Throw it, loser."
"Here."
Toph's throw bends toward the family and almost beheads the tiny girl. The frisbee is picked up by the father, who tries to throw it to me, tossing it like a horseshoe. Poor guy. The park is a haven for innovative people combinations. Even more than Berkeley in general, it's a sort of laboratory. The grass perhaps the grounds of a laboratory for experimental people-making. The mixed race/ethnicity couple capital of the world. Easily half of all couples therein, whether married or dating or on first dates or just jogging together, are somehow mixed, mostly black and white, but often Asian and white, even the somehow less common Asian man-white woman pairing, Latino and white duos, Asian-Latino, black-Asian, a smattering of lesbians. It's been cast by the directors of commercials for banks. Incidentally, Toph and I, routine and inside joke-wise, are in the middle of a jokes about the dubious importance of race period. We're not sure how it started, surely not by the older and more responsible of us, but it goes something like this. I say, "Your hat smells like urine." He says, "You're only saying that because I'm black." Laughs ensue. The construction works for any situation, really. For example, with sexuality. "Are you hassling me again because I'm gay?" And religion.
"Is this because I'm Jewish? Is that it?"
Oh, we have fun. Or at least I have fun, because he barely knows what he's saying. And of course, I'm careful to note that such comedy should stay between us, enjoyed only at home, considering that much, or most of the appeal might be lost on his fellow fifth graders, their parents, or, say, Ms. Richardson. After half an hour or so of superior frisbee playing, we rest in the middle of the kite zone, in the grass, watching the tails jump and ripple around us. The Golden Gate is straight ahead,
looking small, light, made of plastic and piano wire. The city. The city, that is, San Francisco, is cluttered in white and gray to the left, the bay flat, blue, rippling noncommittally, dotted with sailboat feathers and motorboats with comet trails. And then a notion occurs to me. Swim to Alcatraz. That would be something. Swimming not from but to Alcatraz. It doesn't look all that far. Maybe a half mile? It's always so hard to tell with water, but I could do it if the water was calm. Breaststroke. What would be so hard about it? Every time I see an island in a lake or bay, I think I need to swim there. I am an excellent swimmer, I tell myself. As long as I don't panic or wear myself out too soon, it would just be a matter of pacing. And Toph would do it too. That would be something. Us doing the two Alcatraz swim together. That would be a first. Two guys kind of leisurely swimming to Alcatraz together. We just plan it between us, a secret. We'd bring bathing suits one day and just jump off the rocks and go. It's probably illegal. We would be followed by the Coast Guard. Still, that would be amazing. This kind of thing always more impressive with Toph involved. Ow, Jesus. Toph, bored with the rest period, has started picking up the conical pieces of dry dirt produced by the turf aerator, and from about 3 feet away, he is throwing them at me. He is tossing them carefully at my stomach, watching them bounce off, and chuckling to himself with each hit. Because after maybe 20 tosses of the conical dirt fragments, I have still not paid any attention to him, he starts throwing little pine cones. He only has 5 pine cones, though, so every time he's done throwing all 5, he has to walk on his knees around me, sneaky-like, chuckling still, to retrieve them. Then he kneel-walks back to his original spot and starts over. I tolerate it for 3 more rounds, then decide to give him the punishment he wants. The 4th time he walks by, I trip him. Then I sit on him. Then he cries. When I let him up, he laughs.
Sucker!
Because he was pretending to cry, which I should have known since he does not cry, has never cried. But because I have let him up, I have given him room and opportunity for... Jesus. The maneuvers. I dread the maneuvers. He backs up, gets a running start, though still on his knees, and comes at me, doing the maneuver where he slaps his elbow and charges at me. It is one of his 3 maneuvers. These are the 3 maneuvers. A. The flying object maneuver. For this maneuver, his most commonly employed, he takes an object, like a ball or a towel or a pillow, and throws it at me in a kind of elaborate arcing motion. Then, while I'm supposed to be distracted by the object arcing toward me, he comes in after me, right behind the object, shoulder first. The objective, one assumes, is to first cause confusion, then strike a critical blow. B. The slapping the elbow maneuver. This one, the one he is doing at the moment, is newer than the flying object maneuver and makes a little less sense than the flying object maneuver. What he does with the slapping the elbow maneuver is charge at me, right elbow first, sticking it out toward me, in the sort of position one would have if charging with a knife or running to show someone a boo-boo. Then, while he is coming at me, right elbow first, he is also slapping the right elbow with his left hand. It's unclear why he slaps his elbow unless it's for the sake of distraction, like the flying object trick. Of course, where the flying object maneuver succeeds to some extent, the slapping elbow maneuver fails each time because it is only bringing attention to his chosen weapon, i.e., his elbow. C. The slapping the ankle maneuver. This is very similar to the slapping the elbow maneuver, I guess, obviously, except with this maneuver, instead of slapping his elbow, he charges at me while hopping on 1 foot, holding the other foot, the ankle of which he is slapping. This maneuver requires no further comment. So at present, he is coming at me on his knees, elbow first, slapping it with his left palm, looking like an angry, masochistic double amputee. I don't have the energy to move clear in time, so I let him land on my back. Soon we are rolling around on the grass, with me in a few seconds pinning him on his stomach, crossing his legs perpendicularly, his ankle in the back of his knee, then pushing his calf, nutcracker-like, onto his ankle, inducing pain, tremendous pain. Now, he ekes out, his lungs probably collapsed under my weight. Have you had enough
Punishment? Have I had enough what?
I'm kind of bouncing on him now.
Punish?
What? You're not making sense. You have to enunciate.
Enunciate.
People are watching. I jump off, as I usually do when people notice us wrestling in public, because now, as he's getting older and bigger, and because I have creative facial hair, we do not want people to think what I might be thinking if I were watching a grown sort of man sitting on top of a young sort of boy in the middle of a park, making grunting sounds. When it starts getting dark, when the kite people are gone and the joggers arrive, we leave. When we get home, there is a message from Meredith.
Call me as soon as you get this, she says.
I call.
It's John, she says.
She's just gotten off the phone with John, who she says sounds blurry, and he has been talking to her about ingesting the pills he has next to him on the table next to his couch in his apartment in Oakland.
Jesus,
I say, closing the bedroom door.
Yeah.
Why'd he call you?
He said you weren't home.
You think he's serious?
Yeah, maybe. You should get over there.
Should I call him?
No, just go.
I tell Toph to stay.
Lock the door.
I'm in the car. I'm a hero. John would never do it for real. He's just looking for attention.
Oh, but he might. He might fuck it up.
The traffic will be murder. It's 5. Fuck, the traffic's going to suck. Fuck. Take the highway? No, worse. I get down to San Pablo, drive south, straight shot, but why does it have to be 5? There's the radio. It needs to be turned up, because the radio gets turned up when there is fast driving and weaving. The radio is up. This is purpose. Something is happening. The window needs to be opened. The radio needs to be turned up more now that the window is open. Something is happening. He'd never do it. Why would he have told Meredith about the pills if he really meant to do it? Aha. John has been seeing a new therapist, is on Zoloft, and has been acting more and more erratic. Meredith and I have been taking turns dealing.
I've been throwing up all morning, he'll say.
He's always throwing up, dry heaving, spitting up bile, blood, pieces of his liver. No one knows why. He calls. Sounds different. His speech slow, labored.
Where are you?
At home.
Who's there?
No one. Then why do you sound drunk?
It's the medication.
Down San Pablo. It's almost nice here and there, just past university, all the boutiques.
Move your car, dick fuck.
Yes, you move! San Pablo into Oakland, where the buildings are crooked and closed and vacant, look like prop buildings, two-dimensional. Radio's all the way up. Pat Benatar. Oh, Pat Benatar.
Drive your truck, dumbass fuck dick. Drive! Go! Go, beetle-driving cockfuck, you motherfucker!
This is taking way too long. He could be dead by now. Could be dead. He's not dead. He's acting. He wants my attention. He wants sympathy. The spineless. Maybe he will do it. Maybe this is it. Cannot believe this is me again. I'll have a dead friend. Do I want a dead friend?
Maybe I want a dead friend.
There could be so many uses.
No, I don't want a dead friend. Maybe I want a dead friend without having a friend who dies.
At his building, I worry about getting in. Can I buzz? I can't buzz. He won't buzz me in. There's no way. I didn't think of how I'd get in. Fuck, I'll have to climb the fire escape. Maybe break a window. Maybe... Shit, I can just buzz someone else. Any apartment.
Duh.
But they're going to ask who it is, and what will I say? I'm not going to tell them what's happening.
Why wouldn't I tell them what's happening? Tell them about Dickhead with the pills? It's not up to me to keep his secrets.
Fuck. But then, here, a woman walking out. Timely. Perfect. I'll just go through, catch that second door in time. Not a bad-looking woman, kind of elfin, though, smelling like... What is that smell?
Oh, Jessica Strachan, 6th grade.
Oh, Jessica, I owe you a call. I have to remember. The elf woman is kind of cute, actually, maybe a little old, but... Fuck! I run up the 4 flights, 3 steps at a time. I am so quick, like an Indian, and goddammit, even his door is open, and when I burst through and bang the door against the wall for effect, I expect drama, or blood, or his mouth foaming, or his dead-cold blue-green body, maybe naked even. Why naked? Not naked, but he's just there on his futon couch apparatus, drinking wine.
This fucking guy.
What the fuck are you doing?
He just smiles. What am I doing here?
I hate this guy. Or else he's already done it.
Did you already do it?
I'm wired from the drive, the run up the stairs.
Did you already do it? Fuck you if you did, you fucking cocksucker.
There are pills on the table, loose, scattered on top of a batik tablecloth. I point to the pile just there like a little pill display, all spread out like hard candy in a bowl.
What are these?
I ask, pointing.
What the fuck are these?
He shrugs. I scan the apartment. I'm like a cop, a police dog, a robot. I'm scanning for bad things, clues. I'll save his life. I am his only chance. I go to the bathroom, open the medicine cabinet, dumping everything more recklessly than I need to, throwing things. I knock over stuff in the shower, even. It's kind of fun. I come up with two prescription-looking bottles. Evidence. I stomp out and hover over him.
What are these?
He grins. That fucking smile.
What the fuck are these? Are these those?
I point to the table and back to the bottles. I read the labels. Zoloft, Ativan, some other stuff. I know what Zoloft is, but have no idea what the Ativan is. It could be hemorrhoidal stuff.
All right, listen. You tell me right now what the fuck you took, dickwad, or I'm calling the cops.
Dickwad? Where did I get dickwad? I haven't said dickwad for years. Need something more forceful.
I didn't take anything, he says, chuckling, amused by me.
Don't sweat it. Don't worry, he says, with what seems to be exaggerated drunkenness. Asshole.
It's cool. It's mellow.
He's really talking like this? I want to kick him in the head.
Then where are the rest of these?
I point to the pile of pills. He does a cute little shrug, his palms up and everything.
Fuck you, I'm calling the cops. They'll figure it out.
I look for the phone.
Where's your phone?
The phone's on the wall. He's always been neat. Even the empty wine bottles in his pantry are lined up in rows. I start dialing.
Don't,
he says, excited suddenly, drawing out the second don't.
I didn't take anything. Relax. Relax? Yes, relax.
Why are you talking like an asshole? He does a gesture indicating drinking, the throwing back of a shot, the kind of gesture you make when you don't have a drink in your hand. But because he does have a drink in his hand, he spills the wine, the whole glass, down his shirt. Dumb shit. I look at the bottle, almost empty. He's alone and drinking Merlot in the afternoon. I have no idea who this person is. His shins are bruised, his hair bedheaded. What kind of person drinks wine by himself in the afternoon? And that swimsuit calendar. I'm calling anyway.
Aw, fuck you, I'm calling anyway. I'm not having your blood on my hands.
Two. I dial 911 and feel a little thrill. It's my first time. A few rings and boom, an operator. I'm in charge. I have news. I have a situation. I tell the operator about this asshole. I give John the finger while telling her, who may or may not have taken pills. He probably took something, I add, to make sure she sends someone. I hang up and throw the phone at him. They're coming, stupid. I pace around, looking for more clues. The kitchen. I bang open the cabinets, spill a clump of silverware into the sink. It crashes, 100 cymbals.
Hey, what the fuck?
He says.
What the fuck?
I yell from the kitchen.
What the fuck? Fuck you, what the fuck?
I go back to the bathroom, look under the sink. Nothing. I throw the cabinet door closed. I'm making as much noise as I can. I have the right. I'll tear the place apart. I half expect to find anything now. Guns, drugs, gold bullion. This is fiction now. It's fucking fiction. I sit down on the floor in front of him, on the other side of his glass and chrome coffee table. A picture of his parents, a bad snapshot, blown up too big. They're gonna pump your stomach, dummy. He does the cute shrug again, the little grin. I want to pop his skull like a grape. What's the problem? You broke up with someone? I say, purposely not using George's name, driving the point home.
This is because you broke up with somebody? Don't tell me this is because you stopped dating someone.
Whatever.
Jesus.
Fuck you. You don't know what it's like.
What's like?
Suddenly it occurs to me that maybe this is our last conversation. He could be dying, the pills already drowning him, pulling him away. I should be nice. We should be talking about nice things. The drives in central Illinois, those miles so straight where you could drive 80, 90, the windows down, corn gone, just raw, gray fields where you felt like you were plowing through time itself, like you were a huge, loud missile tearing the earth in half, leaving grateful ruin in your wake. But also knowing, we always knew that really, at least seen from anyone else's perspective, it was not that way. To cars going the other way, we were a quick, loud noise, a flash. Seen from above, even a crop duster would have given you the perspective, we were nothing like that. Not loud, not powerful, not affecting much at all, not leaving any ruin, not making any noise. We were just some little black thing puttering straight on the straight road, producing only the smallest buzzing sound, crawling through this flat, terrible grid. So what's it like? I've had, you know, relationship problems, I offer. It's not that. It's this. He points to his head. What? He lolls his head forward like it weighs 1,000 pounds. He's getting drunker every second. There is a dog barking outside. The dog is going nuts. They're dead, John says. Who? He runs his hands through his hair. Oh, the drama. This is just stupid. So I'm not allowed? Right, you're not. You could be getting raped on a Guatemalan hillside. I could be getting what? Listen, all this, I mean the drinking alone, the wine and pills and everything, you're such a fucking cliche. There's a knock on the open door. In here. The cops are huge. They make the room tiny, filling it with black. There are two. They want to know what the problem is. But don't they know? Didn't the dispatcher? When I come to the part about how we don't know what he took or when, I point to John with my thumb, and then, asshole does the cute shrug for the cops. But his eyes are starting to look nervous. Maybe he did take something. I almost feel for him now. Then I see him dead, in the emergency room. The doctor's doing the thing with the electric things, the clear, thump thing. His body thick and fish-like. Then I look at him. His hair looks best like this, long. The crew cut didn't work. He's almost pretty now with his tan. Then dead again. It's like one of those holographic cards you turn and see one picture, turn back and see the other. He is telling them there's nothing to worry about, that he's just having some wine. Don't you two fellas have anything better to do? John asks. But now I want something to happen. I want release. There's been this build-up, and now something has to happen. John reaches for the wine bottle like he's going to pour another glass right here and now, have another nice glass of wine. One of the cops stops to watch, his pen in his mouth, looking so perplexed his eyes are almost crossed. John stops, puts the wine bottle back, and puts his hands in his lap. The other cop is writing things down in his pad. The pad is so small. His pen is really small, too. They seem too small, the pen and pad. Personally, I would want a bigger pad. Then again, with a bigger pad, where would I put it? You'd need a pad holster, which might look cool, but would make it even harder to run, especially if you have the flashlight attachment. I guess you need a small pad so it'll fit on your utility belt. Oh, it'd be so great if they called it a utility belt. Maybe I could ask. Not now, of course, but later. John is just sitting there, his hands clasped together between his bony knees as if waiting for a valentine. The cop's walkie-talkies start fuzzing, talking. Word comes that the paramedics are already on the way. We're told John will be taken in either way to be safe, and with that, it all becomes pretty mundane. The cops are casual. They have seen this kind of thing. I, too, am casual. I almost want to offer them food. I glance into John's kitchen. There's a plate of grapes. Could I offer you fellas some grapes? There's a lunge, and John grabs the pills on the table and swallows all of them. What just happened? One cop asks. There are about 25. Incredible. He just took the pills. What pills? The ones on the table. What, are you people blind? What the fuck is that? I ask John. I want to open his mouth and pry the pills out, like with a cat who's got a chipmunk. That was the stupidest thing I've ever seen. Now they'll definitely pump your stomach. He's got his eyes closed now. You dumb shit? Dumb shit? The ambulance comes, another squad car. When we leave the apartment, John's on a stretcher. It's dark, and the neighborhood is exploding with red and white. The lights skipping along the surrounding buildings. Flashlight tag. I follow in my car. I wonder which hospital they'll go to. How do they decide? We are not headed toward the closest hospital. I've never been where this ambulance is going. The ambulance is going slower than an ambulance should be going. It means either that they are not too concerned about his situation, or that he's already dead. I pull up to a light next to a bunch of young black kids. Maybe they'll shoot me. I'm in the zone of all probability. I cannot be surprised. Earthquakes, locusts, poison rain would not impress me. Visits from God, unicorns, bat people with torches and scepters. It's all plausible. If these kids happen to be bad kids and have guns and want to shoot someone for an initiation or whatever reason bad kids shoot people like me, it will be me. The glass will break and the bullet will come through and I will not be surprised. With a bullet in my head, I will drive my car into a tree, and as I am waiting to be pulled from the wreck, nearly dead, I will not panic or yell. I will think only, weird, this is exactly what I expected. As we approach Ashby, I'm trying to remember that riddle, the one about the kid who's sick and the doctor can't operate on him because the kid's related to the doctor, or it's the doctor's son, and how can that be? I can't remember the fucking thing. I lose the ambulance at a light. When I get to the hospital, the doctor, a tired, ponytailed woman in her mid-30s, comes to brief me, but is not sympathetic.
So, you're friends with the big actor?
I call Beth from the waiting room. She goes over to watch Toaf. I have to stay until John's stomach is empty.
How long will it take?
She asks. I don't know. An hour? Two? I sit in the waiting room.
And oh, that Conan. That Conan is killing me. I'm watching the TV from across the waiting room full of cheap chairs and loud with two children and their mother, a stout woman. They're making so much noise I can't hear Conan. Conan's doing this Live Aid kind of thing where he's putting together a sort of benefit song, and he and Andy are arguing because Conan's being this huge prima donna, even though he can't sing to save his life. I can barely hear over the shrieking of the kids. I move chairs so I'm closer. There. Now Sting gets into it. Oh, that's a nice touch, getting Sting in there. And he's recording with Andy and Conan. Also that Springsteen drummer, the mailman-looking one with the frozen smile. I am chortling. It's the funniest fucking thing.
I start wishing I had a pen, some paper. Details of all this will be good. This will make some kind of short story or something. Or no, people have done stuff about suicides before, but I could twist it somehow, include random things, what I was thinking on the way to the hospital, about Indian summer, the doctor riddle, about watching Conan. That's a good detail, the laughing while your friend is having his stomach pumped. People have done that too, probably on TV even. Picket fences, maybe. But I could take it further. I should take it further. I could be aware, for instance, in the text of it having been done before, but that I have no choice but to do it again, it having actually happened that way. But then it will sound like one of those things where the narrator, having grown up media-saturated, can't live through anything without it having echoes of similar experiences in television, movies, books, blah, blah. Goddamn kids! The shrieking is the problem. It's fine, except for the fucking shrieking! So I'll have to take it past that. I'll convey that while I'm living these things very similar to things I've seen happen before, I will be simultaneously recognizing the value in living through these things, as horrible as they are, because they will make great material later, especially if I take notes, either now on my hand, with a pen borrowed from the ER receptionist, or when I get home. Maybe there's one in my car. But getting it would be crass. So instead of lamenting the end of unmediated experience, I will celebrate it, revel in the simultaneous living of an experience and its dozen or so echoes in art and media. The echoes making the experience not cheaper, but richer, aha! Being that much more layered, the depth, luxurious, not soul-sucking or numbing, but edifying, ramifying. So there is first the experience, the friend and the threatened suicide, then there are the echoes from these things having been done before, then the awareness of echoes, the anger at the presence of echoes, then the acceptance, embracing of presence of echoes as enrichment, and above all, the recognition of the value of the friend threatening suicide and having stomach pumped as both life experience and also as fodder for experimental short story or passage in novel, not to mention more reason to feel experientially superior to others one's age, especially those who have not seen what I have seen, all the things I have seen, another experience that can be checked off, like skydiving, backpacking through Europe, a menage a trois. Oh, these fat kids. Look at these kids, these little porkers. Is that a genetic thing? Disgusting, the existence of fat kids. So I could be aware of the dangers of the self-consciousness, but at the same time, I'll be plowing through the fog of all these echoes, plowing through mixed metaphors, noise, and will try to show the core, which is still there, as a core, and is valid, despite the fog. The core is the core is the core. There is always the core that can't be articulated. Only caricatured. I go in to see him. He has a tube sticking out of his mouth, one out of his nose. The one in his mouth seems too thick, the setup almost lewd. His face is milky, drawn as if the tube has drained more than his stomach, has taken everything, a sort of punishment. He's asleep, sedated. Morphine, maybe? His head pointing up and to his left, in the direction of the respirator. It looks like his hands are tied to the bed. His hands are tied to the bed. The bindings are thick, black, Velcro. He must have resisted or swung at someone. His legs are spread, his arms out, his left hand still looking tense, gripping something not there. Those little chicken legs of his, bruised up and down from bumping into furniture, drunk. And he's barefoot. It's too cold to be barefoot. And the floor isn't as clean as one would expect. Shouldn't it be cleaner? They should clean. I could clean. I've seen this before, somehow, this room. I've been here, this room is the room my mom was brought to for the nosebleed. They brought her first to the emergency room, connected her, transfusions, pouring blood into her. But this room is much too big and white. This huge room, separate from the rest of the ward, must have been built for more than one bed. As is, it is too dramatic, his bed centered in the floor, all this space. I am standing across the room, unsure whether I want to touch him to get any closer. It won't make a difference, he'll never know. He's asleep. You could put pictures up in a room like this. It would be nice to have some pictures up, like they have in a dentist's office, something to look at while you're being worked on. But then you'd be dying, and the last thing you would see would be some Leroy Neiman print from the 1983 Masters, and that would be just too terrible. Not that there could ever be any appropriate thing to see before you died, but if you really liked golf, they should leave the walls blank. I lean my shoulder against the wall, then rest my head against it and watch for a while, palm on the white cinder block. He was such a skinny kid when he was little. Always looked smaller, a few years younger because of it. But he was an amazing swimmer, just amazing. In the pool, in the ocean, a beautiful stroke. I try for a second, something to do, to time my breaths to his, watching his chest rise and fall, the rest of his body immobile, the hands and fists. The hands tied down as the color continues to drain. I watch the stupid fucking dickhead asshole sleep. Then he gets up. He is awake, and he is standing and pulling the tubes from his mouth, from his arms, the nodes and electrodes, barefoot. I jump. Jesus fucking Christ, what are you doing? Fuck it. What do you mean, fuck it? I mean, fuck it, asshole. I'm leaving. What? Screw it. I'm not going to be a fucking anecdote in your stupid book. He's looking through the drawers. What are you looking for? Clothes, fuckface. I'm getting out of here. You can't just leave. You're drugged and everything. Oh, please. I can do what I want. I'm going home. I'm telling the nurse. You're supposed to stay overnight, and then I stay here until 3 a.m. or so when they say you're safe and sleeping fine, and then with heavy heart, I finally go home to Toph, to more obligation. Then I come in tomorrow and visit you in the psychiatric ward, and then, listen, dipshit, screw it. This is such fucking garbage. I'm just supposed to lie there with my bruised shins and everything while you get to play the dutiful friend, always there for me, all responsible, while I'm lost and worthless? Listen, fuck it. I want no part of that. Find someone else to be symbolic of, you know, youth wasted or whatever. Listen, John. Who's John? You're John. I'm John? Yeah, I changed your name. Oh, right. Now, why John again? That was my dad's name. Jesus, so I'm your dad too? Fuck, man, this is just too much. You are such a freak. I'm a freak? I'm a freak? Fuck you, I'm a freak. Okay, I'm the freak. I'm the freak. Whatever. But I didn't ask you to broadcast all this. What the fuck are you talking about? You're the one who put yourself in here in the first place. You're telling me you took a handful of pills in front of me and two cops and you didn't want attention? Fuck you. But that doesn't mean, yeah, it does not.
Listen, I give you the attention you want and have been giving it to you for years, listening to you ramble about every fucking up and down you have, about how they wouldn't let you join the one gym and about this breakup and that, fights with Meredith and whoever else. I mean, it's not really interesting stuff, I have to tell you, but I've been listening all along. I mean, I know you have your therapist convinced that you've had the worst life of all time, and I can't believe you really told her that you had been abused as a child, you fucking liar. But, you know, your current crop of problems and this new drinking thing, it's all just boredom. Emphasis on the bore part. It's boring. You're bored. You're lazy. I mean, every single thing is so boring. Alcohol, pills, suicide? I mean, no one will even believe this shit. It's so fucking boring.
So leave it out, then. It's not that boring.
You're sick.
Whatever.
This is mine. You've given it to me. We're trading. I gave you the attention you wanted. I bail you out. When you spend 3 days in the psych ward and say how you're still thinking of doing it, I'm the one who comes in and sits on your bed and gives you the big pep talk.
Anyway, the point is that because of all that, all the shit I put in for you, now I get this. This is mine also. And you, because you've done it yourself, made yourself the thespian, you have to fulfill that contract. Play the dates. Go on the road. Now you're the metaphor.
He's quiet. He has a pair of scrubs in his hand that he found in a cabinet. He tosses them under the counter.
Fine. Put me in the fucking book.
Really?
Yeah. You're not just doing this for me.
Does it matter?
Not really.
Whatever. I'll get back onto the bed, lie down and everything. You'll have to tie me down again.
I will. And give me more of that morphine, if you don't mind.
Sure, sure.
Listen, I really appreciate this.
I know.
Get me the tube.
Here.
Thanks.
I'll fix the blanket.
Here.
Okay. This is gonna be great. You'll see.
John has to spend 3 days in a psychiatric ward. He calls me and I call back. The phone rings 12 or 13 times. An older man answers.
Hello?
He whispers it.
Hi, is John there?
Who?
A guy named John. Tallish guy, blondish hair.
Oh, no, no. No one's available at the moment.
Why not?
Well, everyone's in group. They'll be in group for an hour at least. I had to leave group to answer the phone. They asked me to leave and answer the phone.
It dawns on me that I'm talking to a patient. Well, can you take a message?
Long pause.
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to. Wait.
The phone is dropped loudly. I can hear it swinging from its cord. After a full minute or so, he picks it up, breathing heavily.
Okay, I think I can risk it.
I ask him to tell John I called.
Okay, John called.
No, I'm calling John.
Oh.
He is fretting.
You're calling John. Does he know you? Are you a relative?
No.
Are you his father?
No.
Well, you can't call if...
Okay, I'm his dad.
No, you're not. You just said...
Listen, I'll call back. Don't worry about it.
Oh, thank you.
I come by later in the afternoon. I am led to the door and sign the registry. Down the hall is a common room with blue carpet, a few couches, and a butcher block table. It looks a little like a seventh grade classroom. John is through the first door on the left, lying on his side, hands between his legs on a bed in a dark room. A blanket covers his feet. I sit on the bed opposite.
So, do you smell it?
He asks.
Smell what?
Can't you smell it?
No, what is it?
The other guy couldn't find the toilet last night.
What other guy? My roommate, the old black guy out there.
Oh. All last night, on and on, he was moaning, tapping on the window, crying. He was saying, I'm dying, somebody please help me, I'm dying. It was unbelievable.
Was he dying?
No, he wasn't dying, he was taking a dump.
I thought you said he was by the window.
He was. He couldn't find the bathroom, so he let her go out right there, standing by the window.
Oh.
Then he got all quiet, and in the morning there was shit everywhere. It had gone down his leg and onto his shoe, and during the night he had walked around.
Okay, fine.
There were shit footprints in the room, in the hallway.
Okay, so they moved me to another room for a while, then they cleaned the floor and moved me back. I can't smell anything.
Yeah, they sprayed or something.
It actually smells nice.
They tied me to the bed.
When?
For most of the next day after I came in.
Huh. He wants me to be outraged or impressed. I'm not sure which. Is that standard?
Drove me fucking crazy. Look at my arms.
He shows me his wrists, rubbed raw, bluish.
And look.
He shows me his ankles, red and splotchy.
I mean, have you ever been tied up?
Well, let me think. I think of a few trenchant things I could say. No, I've never been tied up. Then. But I've also never pretended to commit suicide. What did you say?
Nothing.
Fuck you. No, fuck you.
You think that was an act? You and that fucking nurse. She was such a fucking bitch. She called me Martin Sheen.
You don't look like Martin Sheen. She meant it like acting, like I was acting Apocalypse Now.
Oh, I've never seen that.
You haven't? Not all the way through. Not the part she's talking about. I look at him for a second. You look more like Emilio. He gets up on his elbows to look at me.
This isn't funny.
I know.
They tied me up because they thought I might do it again.
Why would they think that?
Because I said I would.
But you won't.
Why not?
The feces man walks in. His skin is purple and gray. He waves. He sits for a minute on his bed, smoothing the sheet with his palm. Then he gets up and shuffles out. John leans towards me, whispers.
See how he walks? They all do that. The Thorazine shuffle.
Yeah.
You know I'm locked in?
I figured.
As in I can't leave, even if I want to.
Yeah, well,
I mean, that's weird, right? That these people who I don't even know can prevent me from leaving? It's weird, just on a philosophical level, right?
I agree that it is weird.
I'm so tired, he says.
Me too, I say, perhaps too quickly. We're all tired. He brings his knees to his chest.
No, I'm really tired,
he says. He rolls onto his side, his back to me. He wants to be encouraged. I put my hand on his shoulder. I can't believe he's going to make me give him the speech. I am livid that he's going to make me give him the speech.
I do it, piecing it together from times I've seen it done on TV and in movies. I tell him that there are many people who love him and would be crushed if he were to kill himself, while wondering, distantly, if that is the truth. I tell him that he has so much potential, that he has so many things to do, while most of me believes that he will never put his body and brain to much use at all. I tell him that we all have dark periods, while becoming ever more angry at him, the theatrics, the self-pity, all this, when he has everything. He has a complete sort of freedom, with no parents and no dependents, with money and no immediate threats of pain or calamity. He is in the 99.9th percentile, as I am. He has no real obligations, can go anywhere at any moment, sleep anywhere, move at will, and still he is wasting everyone's time with this.
But I hold that back. I will save that for later, and instead say nothing but the most rapturous and positive things. And though I do not believe much of it, he does. I make myself sick saying it all. Everything's so obvious. The reasons to live not at all explainable in a few minutes on the edge of a psychiatric ward bed. But still, he is roused, making me wonder even more about him. Why a fudge-laden pep talk can convince him to live. Why he insists on bringing us both down here to this pedestrian level. How he cannot see how silly we both look, and when exactly it was that his head got so soft, when I lost track of him, how it is that I know and care about such a soft and pliant person. Where was it again that I parked my car?